This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to the Friday Pitch-In, where we cover a few different topics, not just one. And we always start with a look at the week's biggest state stories with our digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, how's it going?
Not too bad. How much did you work this week?
All of it, yeah.
Including New Year's Eve and New Year's Day?
New Year's Eve, not New Year's Day. New Year's Day, I was brunching at Waffle House.
Okay, and that was necessary.
I plead the fifth.
Okay. All right, let's get into the news. We saw a number of stories come through this week on education priorities. Let's unpack some of that.
Yeah, you know, the legislative session starts on January 6th. So the big one that's a huge priority for Republican leaders is legislation to hold schools and teachers harmless from the iLearn results that we received earlier this year or last year. That legislation has a hearing next Tuesday, actually. So they are, you know, really moving and shaking to try and get this legislation through as soon as humanly possible. Everyone seems to be on board for the stipulations of it and just want to get it out and done.
And this was because iLearn scores came back pretty bad across the board.
Yeah.
It's a new test. A variety of factors.
Yeah, new tests. Generally speaking, students don't perform that super well on new tests. And that's one of the reasons why Hold Harmless has been necessary a handful of times in the last 10 years. And so this one seems kind of standard procedure at this point. New standardized test for students in Indiana. You got to hold harmless the schools and the teachers.
And there's another factor here involving teacher evaluations as well.
Yeah. So along those same lines, they're wanting to decouple teacher evaluations from student teaching or from student testing. Representative Todd Houston, the speaker-elect, and a representative from Fishers brought it up at the press conference announcing his selection as the speaker-elect. And the other GOP leaders have danced around the idea quite a bit. But there have been two bills authored so far, one in the House and one in the Senate. And the House version has been authored by the Education Vice Chairman Tony Cook, which lends a lot of credibility to the legislation. It's certainly not a done deal by any stretch of the imagination, but that is the kind of push that we have not seen historically in Indiana for that kind of legislation.
Mm. And another part of this are the career awareness licensure requirements that are kind of at a point of contention right now among both teachers and legislators.
Absolutely. I mean, these career awareness requirements triggered a 1,000% increase in teachers trying to renew their licenses before the new requirement took effect. And it's actually a Holcomb priority to make this controversial career awareness requirement optional. Other GOP leaders have started to support looking into it and walking back the requirement. But essentially, it outlines that teachers who are renewing their license through professional growth point plans, 15 out of the 90 hours of required professional development needed to be from career awareness training, like an internship.
Or an externship, as it were. We did a show on this. And yeah, the feelings are strong.
Definitely. And so, you know, those feelings have to a certain extent been heard, especially by the governor. And so they're, you know, ready to walk that back.
And we will hear a lot more on this in our next segment with education reporter Jeannie Lindsay. And speaking of Jeannie, what else has she reported on?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things she and I talked about ahead of the show, she said that all of these education focused bills filed so far kind of make this session look like a warm up to the 2021 session, where GOP lawmakers are planning on tackling the bigger issues like unfunded mandates, teacher pay, and accountability. But outside of the scope of those big ticket items, there are two education priorities that are very interesting. So there's this anti-discrimination bill, and this comes out of the school voucher program. School corporations like the Archdiocese of Indianapolis can legally discriminate against LGBTQ teachers because they aren't publicly funded, but they do receive state funding through the school voucher program. Last year, a similar bill was filed, and this year, Democratic State Senator J.D. Ford has authored a bill to prevent that, and has the backing of the Republican State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick. think.
Mm. But that's they're not expecting really for that to go very far.
No. In the 2019 legislative session, only 7 out of 153 Senate Democrat authored pieces of legislation became law, and more than 85% didn't get a committee hearing. So their rallying cry right now is just getting a committee hearing to have a broader conversation about this anti-discrimination bill.
And back to the 2021 talk, a lot of these things that we're talking about doing in 2021 are because next year is a budget session.
Yeah.
And so we can have that flexibility with the money that we wouldn't otherwise this year.
Mm-hmm.
That's why.
Yeah. I mean, Republican leaders have said on a number of occasions they're not opening up the budget other than for a couple of state surplus funding projects. So, you know, these are sort of the conversations that are happening ahead of 2021.
And which is one of the big things that the Red for Ed rally wanted was higher teacher pay. And that would involve opening up the budget, which they're just not willing or prepared to do at this time.
Yeah, even in response to the Red for Ed rallies and everything else, GOP leaders have remained very firm that they are not interested in opening up the budget.
All right, let's look at Rebecca Thiel's reporting on these environmental priorities.
Yeah, so there are two things that she's really looking at. And the first one, which is the most straightforward, is SB 63, which is likely in response to the big debate over logging and whether or not the DNR is going about it in the right way. So this bill would establish a state forest commission, which would be responsible for establishing a plan to manage state forests for the next for a 100-year period beginning in 2023. A lot of environmentalists say the state has, because of the increased logging rates in the state, they aren't doing that in the best interest of state forests. And so that's likely a response to that.
It all depends on who you talk to with regard to that. I mean, some people argue that they are doing it in the best interest. And it is happening. I went for a hike in a state forest on New Year's Eve, and there was active logging taking place in several areas that have transformed the landscape. But again, the argument is there are different arguments on both sides.
Absolutely. And Rebecca did a survey of foresters across the country. And basically what she discovered from their responses was the DNR's philosophy for managing state forest growth fits in line pretty easily with everybody else's. But, you know, environmentalists are looking at the state of forests and they're also concerned about things as well. So this is essentially attempting to establish a commission that gives them a voice in that process and creates a little bit better transparency.
And what's this I see about solar panels?
Yeah, so this is kind of wonky. It would allow homeowners associations to prohibit solar panels. So fun fact about me, I worked for a law office that dealt with HOA covenants.
Okay.
So this is precisely the kind of crunchy that I love. So if you don't live in a homeowners association, and if you didn't work for an HOA attorney, the association has a set of covenants or rules that help maintain the property value of the neighborhood, and the fees that you pay go to certain amenities like snow plowing and community area upkeep. So last year, a bill to prevent homeowners associations from banning solar panels actually got quite a bit of traction, but it didn't quite make it to the end. This bill does the exact opposite of that, which is allowing HOAs to ban solar panels. So it's kind of interesting to see where it'll go, if it goes anywhere.
Hmm. Okay. What about these health items that have come up?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the two big health items was taken care of by the federal government. Indiana now has to comply with the federal regulations, which raised the legal tobacco age from 18 to 21 on December 20th.
Mm-hmm.
So now the state doesn't have to do anything about it, and it's just done. But the other big health push is tackling health care costs. So lawmakers expect to pass a bill for transparency in medical prices and a ban on surprise billing, where patients, for instance, find out after a procedure that one of the doctors was out of network. That came out of a summer study committee that looked into why healthcare costs in Indiana trend so much higher than our neighbors. So we can expect some movement on that this session.
Okay, that'll be interesting. And the smoking age, when that came down, that must have been a sigh of relief for Bosma.
It's definitely one of those where it's, Indiana waited and the federal government took care of it. Everybody else got on board.
And it was kind of a big surprise thing. It kind of happened really fast.
Yeah, it was included in, I think it was included in the spending bill, which is why it just kind of snuck in there at the, you know, kind of the last second, and very much to address youth vaping in the country.
Okay. A couple other final points here on hands-free driving. The governor wants this?
Yeah, this is one of Holcomb's 2020 priorities. He wants to ban Hoosiers from using their cell phones while driving unless they're hands-free. So Indiana already bans texting while driving, but it's largely unenforceable because there are so many other legal ways to use a phone that still qualifies as distracted driving. So he's really wanting to push for that.
And so this will kind of blanket over the general use of the phone and distracting your eyes from the road.
Yeah. So it's more similar to, you know, places like Florida where you have to, if your phone is in your hand, that is illegal while you are driving. And so doing something a little bit closer to that, you know, definitely can limit some of the distracted driving that Holcomb is concerned about.
And what's this that the BMV is trying to change?
Yeah, so the BMV has long allowed people to change their gender on their license, but that policy came under scrutiny in 2019 and prompted the agency to establish a formal procedure. So lawmakers will likely file legislation in the 2020 session over those proposed rules. But that being said, Speaker Brian Bosma says he doesn't want the legislature to get involved. But he also says that he knows that his caucus is still going to propose legislation to do so. So depending on how far that gets, that may or may not end up becoming a law. But there's definitely going to be some activity on it this session.
OK, so Bosma says hands off on this for now unless we need to step in.
Yeah.
Let's talk about 2022 Way, which is an initiative that you and some of our friends here are working on in the last minute or so that we have.
Yeah. So, of course, the Indiana 2022 Way is a more intimate conversation between us and you, the folks who are listening to us right now. And so we have a text tool that allows you to text elections to 73224. And then we get to have a conversation with you. So the day after Christmas, we sent out our legislative adventure tool, which is a tool that I built with a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, mostly sweat. It functions like a certain adventure book series that is heavily trademarked and apparently litigious. So, but yes, you get to walk through the legislative session. We also have a printable guide so that you can better understand all of the different parts of the legislative session and when you should get involved. So for things like that and all of the cool stuff that we do on the internet and on air, join our two-way group so that we can talk to you about the issues of the 2020 session and the 2020 election as a whole.
And very quickly, how do they do that?
Text elections to 73224.
All right. Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer Lauren Chapman, thanks as always.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, more on the progress of the Red for Ed movement. What are teachers getting? What are they not getting? Indiana Public Broadcasting education reporter Jeannie Lindsay joins us from Bloomington next. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Teachers across Indiana gathered at the State House for the Red for Ed rally in November. As we head into the 2020 legislative session next week, what education issues remain priorities for legislators and teachers' unions? We're joined today by Indiana Public Broadcasting's education reporter Jeannie Lindsay to learn what movement we've seen around hot-button education topics since the rally and what we can anticipate moving into the legislative session this year. Jeannie, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
It's been several weeks since the Red for Ed rally at the State House on Organization Day. Can you remind us what the core components really, what they were? What were they asking for, the teachers?
Right. So the Indiana State Teachers Association was kind of the spearheading authority behind the Red for Ed rally. And so they outlined three primary objectives, primary goals. And those were about the iLearn scores. They wanted to hold schools and teachers harmless for a drop in student achievement on those. They wanted the removal of a new career awareness licensure renewal rule. And then they wanted more money for schools schools aimed hopefully at teacher pay, but, you know, for the broader operations of schools from the state's surplus. So testing, hold harmless, removal of the new career awareness licensure, and then more money for schools.
All right. So let's start with that piece around teacher pay and getting more money into classrooms. Have we seen any movement on this issue?
So not really. Lawmakers are moving into a non-budget writing year. And so lawmakers and the governor have both signaled that big movement on teacher pay is going to be reserved primarily for 2021.
And we've heard a lot about that technicality getting in the way of a lot of potential legislation this year. And is that the main reason that they're hesitant to put more funding into education right now?
Yeah, so traditionally in a non-budget year, lawmakers, the state doesn't like to open up the state budget to rework it. They have done that in the past for different projects, for different items, but this year they are really hoping to not do that. They've also been pointing to the things that they did already this year. So state funding was on the table in the 2019 budget that they just approved, and they are hoping that that will hold over until the 2021 school year. They want more data. They want more information is something that they've said about how school budget funding gets to teacher salaries. So they're really kind of holding back on sending more money into the school arena before they have more information just about how it all works.
We know that there's a compensation commission tasked with taking a look at teacher pay. Can you give us an idea of what the goals of this commission are?
So this commission is designed to make recommendations to lawmakers. Their ultimate goal is going to be before the 2021 session to recommend changes on how the state can sustainably and kind of formulaically have a teacher salary increase across the board, how they can really take care of teacher salaries in the long term and not just, as some people have put it, put a Band-Aid on the problem. So they really want to do something that's more sustainable. Governor Holcomb has said, you know, he wants a formula. He wants to know how this works to do this effectively in the long term so it's not just a one-time solution. So that compensation commission has had input sessions to hear from teachers, and they will, like I said, have recommendations for the General Assembly and the governor ahead of 2021.
I'm curious, do we know who makes up this commission? Are there teachers at the table, or is this exclusively a group of state officials?
So this actually has a set of business executives on the commission. It's kind of a two-part body. So there is the commission itself that has business executives. There's a representative from Ivy Tech Community College on there. And then there is an advisory council that is supposed to work with the commission. And they have more representation from folks who work in the K-12 space. There's a math teacher. There's a school superintendent, an HR coordinator for schools, the executive director of IST. TA sits on that advisory council. So the commission itself is mostly business execs, but the advisory council does have some representation from the teacher sphere, from the K-12 school sphere that they're hoping to work together.
Some legislators are boasting of pay raises to their teachers on account of referendums passed this last election. Should this be considered a win for teachers, or is this just a drop in the bigger bucket of needs at hand?
So I would say anytime teachers get a bump in base pay, there's some sort of win there. But overall, pointing to referendum funding, it's not really addressing the systemic changes that many teachers want. Not every district can achieve a referendum. They can't pass one. Most schools haven't even proposed one. So there are winners there with the referendum funding helping raise those base teacher salaries. But not everybody can do that. And so, and for many people, that's a huge problem. So, and there are also many different elements of teachers' needs and desires and demands that are beyond teachers' pay. So I think it's definitely a step, but not a fix-all for sure.
Let's move to this issue around career awareness licensure. What's the latest update here?
So lawmakers passed that just in the 2019 session. So this is brand new and they're already thinking about revising it. Lawmakers have said that they are willing to relook at this. They want to know how to make it more effective, if to make it optional for some teachers versus not. So they are willing to, they've signaled that they're willing to do some work on this and focus on it again. But the governor has said that he wants to make it completely optional.
Yeah, what kind of reactions or thoughts have you heard from teachers on this idea of this being optional rather than a requirement for licensure?
Right. So teachers have really been pushing for this since they found out about this requirement, because it's attached to how most teachers in the state renew their licenses. They can't renew their licenses to teach unless they have this 15 points of career awareness training on their record. So teachers want it to be optional, and they're a huge fan of making it an option. ISTA has called for a complete repeal of the law of the career awareness requirement, but I think that their whole point is to make it optional. So I think they're definitely big fans of the optional effort from Holcomb, but I think that they're also, you know, wary of something that might make it voluntary for some and not others. So they really want it to be an optional situation, because the teachers that I've talked to agree with the idea behind it, you know, connecting careers and local industry to schools, but they do not want teachers to be the ones on the line to do that.
And is this opinion from Governor Holcomb a result of hearing the teachers at the Red for Ed rally?
So someone actually asked Governor Holcomb this question, and he says no. He says that this whole time, you know, since the requirement rolled out, you know, he's kind of had a different opinion on it. He wasn't actually at the Red for Ed rally, but he, you know, has been talking a little bit about it, and the career awareness situation, he's said from the outset that he does not think that it should be required for everyone. So he's kind of saying that that's been his opinion all along, and that the Red for Ed rally kind of maybe reinforced that for him, but didn't change his mind by any means.
So then, generally speaking, what has the governor's response been to the Red for Ed rally? Has he been responsive at all to the issues that they asked about?
So I think he's definitely acknowledged the Red for Ed rally, but in terms of him pivoting on any issues or changing his opinion significantly, I don't think that it's had that effect. He was on a previously scheduled trip during the Red for Ed rally, but he already had the Teacher Compensation Commission working. And so he's, since the Red for Ed rally, he's pointed to the work of the commission. He's, you know, pointed to the funding increases that happened in 2019. He's already on board with the Hold Harmless legislation for iLearn. And he said that the PGP career awareness requirement should be optional. So he's on board in a lot of ways with teachers already. So I think that's why we haven't seen as much, I guess, talk from him about the effect of the Red for Ed rally, because I think he feels that he might already be on board in a lot of ways and has been trying to show that.
Well, let's talk about the iLearn issue. Are these iLearn scores going to impact evaluations of teachers in schools this year?
So unless something super crazy happens, the answer is no. Those will not affect school teachers, schools or teachers in their evaluations this upcoming year. In fact, the State Board of Education has already passed a resolution saying that they will not assign school letter grades until lawmakers have had the opportunity to pass some sort of legislation about the Hold Harmless. So no, the answer is that iLearn will not have an impact this year on teacher evaluations or school letter grades.
Well, let's say something crazy does happen and they were to impact a teacher's evaluation. Can you give us an idea of how much weight these scores would have on that evaluation? Is there a standardized rubric of sorts across the state?
So Indiana law says that student testing from the state and on school assessments must, quote, significantly inform teacher evaluations, but that's mostly up to schools. So schools submit their evaluation plans to the Department of Education, and there is a statewide rubric that schools can use instead of coming up with their own, and that's called RISE. And that rubric says that student learning outcomes can weigh anywhere from 10 to 20%. 90% of teachers' evaluations, and that includes testing. So the closest we can get to a number for everybody would maybe be 10 to 20%, but Indiana law for everyone says that the testing has to be significantly informing of the teacher evaluations. But like I said, that is something that each school district submits their evaluation plans to the Department of Education.
And correct me if I'm wrong, there has been discussion about separating test scores for teacher evaluations for good. Can you outline what's behind this argument?
Right. And this is something that a lot of teachers have been wanting for some time now. And the big argument there is that testing is just a snapshot of one day of a student's academic career. They really want to have the emphasis on growth, or, you know, having an evaluator actually in the classroom looking at how teachers are teaching. But the test scores themselves, just that snapshot of one day of testing, they really want to move away from it. And we've talked to some teachers specifically, you know, in the younger grade levels. Not every student in Indiana goes through preschool or has a high quality pre-K before they go into kindergarten. Not every kindergartner starts at the same age. And so for early elementary teachers, it's especially hard when they are having all of these kids coming into school at different starting points and then being expected to meet the same proficiency level in third grade, which is when they do their first state test. And so the argument there is that teachers might move kids, you know, a year and a half or more in terms of their academic knowledge, but that might not necessarily be on grade level depending where they started from. So, and teacher evaluations affect, you know, bonuses and pay increases. And so it's a big deal.
Let's go back to the governor's education agenda. You've reported that unfunded mandates are something that he's looking to give more attention to. Can you explain what he's looking at here?
Right. So this is another thing that's been on teachers' minds and schools' minds is the number of requirements that are placed on schools and teachers that are not provided with any funding. So that's hard on a school when those just keep piling up. And a lot of schools and teachers have been pointing that out and saying that and talking about it. And so the governor, there's already been some work on this from lawmakers. There was a study committee this summer that looked at, you know, the unfunded mandates and trainings and how to kind of streamline those and make those effective and efficient. And so Holcomb is proposing, you know, a closer look at those for big action again in 2021, if he is still the governor after the 2020 election.
The teachers' unions have also outlined their priorities for the legislative session this year. We know that those core issues around funding, iLearn, and licensure are front of mind, but there were some other points of focus as well. The Indiana State Teachers Association is pushing to increase the number of school counselors to support students. What would the union like to see here?
Right. So we've heard a lot of people talking about student mental health, specifically in school safety conversations. And even though they aren't pairing this with school safety, this is definitely an effort to improve student mental health. The ratio of counselors in the state is actually really high. There's a report from the state's School Counselor Association, and it says that Indiana's average ratio of students to counselors is nearly 500 to 1. So 500 students for every one school counselor. And so the teachers union is pushing for more social workers in schools, more psychologists in schools to support students who a lot of teachers have said, you know, are coming to school with more weight of, you know, their home life on them. And so they're really just looking for something to in schools to help support students so that their, you know, lives outside of school or even other things inside of school don't affect their learning abilities negatively.
Another piece that the union would like to see is accountability for all schools that receive state funding. Are we talking about charter schools here?
Yes, and they are talking about brick and mortar charter schools and virtual charter schools. If you remember this last summer, there was some explosive findings for some of the state's virtual charter schools, and that is still on people's minds. We might see an accountability measure come up this next session, but yes, ISTA is talking about accountability for brick and mortar schools, virtual charter schools. Another type of school that's on people's minds, especially public education advocates, is voucher schools. So we might see them push for more accountability for any school that receives state dollars. But the virtual charter schools definitely caught their eye.
And figuring out the best funding formula for schools with large populations of at-risk students is also a priority of the Indiana State Teachers Association. You recently reported, Jeannie, that the number of homeless students enrolled in Hoosier schools nearly doubled between 2008 and 2018. What conversations are being had around this issue right now?
Right. So there's this thing called the complexity index that lawmakers use to offer more funding to schools that serve populations of at-risk students. And that was a conversation during this last budget year in 2019. And lawmakers have already been looking at it to I guess, make it better and more useful for schools. So there was a study committee this summer to talk about the way the state needs to account for at-risk students, you know, what they need to be looking at, whether it's poverty or, you know, other factors. And so the state is trying to figure out how, when they give funding to schools, how to offer more, you know, support to schools that are serving those at-risk students. The complexity index takes into account poverty, but not homelessness specifically. And that doesn't necessarily align with what causes homelessness or the supports schools offer to those homeless kids. And so it's not a budget year this year, like we've already said, but I'm sure there will be more work on that, maybe through a study committee this year. So when we come back in 2021, they have a really clear idea of, or a clearer idea of how to really help these schools serve these kids that need it.
All right. Indiana Public Broadcasting education reporter Jeannie Lindsay, thanks so much for your reporting.
Yeah, absolutely.
And as always, you can share your thoughts on today's conversations on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. When we come back, we'll be joined by Chuck Marone, the author of the new book, Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. We'll take a look back at the model our cities and towns used to be built around and learn why Chuck thinks it's time to reconsider the strategies that make for good investments in the neighborhoods that you and I live in today. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. How we build our cities is a topic that Chuck Marone has given a lot of thought to. And in his book, Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity, Chuck hopes to change the conversation around growth, development, and the future of our cities. Chuck, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Your book, Strong Towns, presents the case that the way we build cities in North America is fundamentally flawed. What is it that we're doing wrong?
It's a long conversation. Let's try to break it down to a couple quick observations. After World War II, in response to the Great Depression and the prospect that we might slip back into depression, we embarked on this experiment, this brand new way and we describe it as a kinetic growth machine, rebuild an entire continent. We literally threw away thousands of years of gained wisdom and knowledge on how to build places that were strong and resilient and adaptable. And we adopted an approach that was designed to grow very, very quickly. That it did. We even talk about today at the 50s and 60s as this nostalgic period of time where, you know, a middle-class family could have one wage earner and live a really great life and see their standard of living increase. The fundamental problem for local communities, for cities, for towns, for neighborhoods with this pattern is that as we achieve this astounding level of growth at the national level, cities are taking on all kinds of unpayable liabilities. We're all familiar with pensions and how we struggle to pay them. But I think an even deeper problem, a problem that's even more existential than pensions, that's harder to believe, is all the infrastructure we've created as part of this development pattern. When you spread people out over a huge area, That takes an enormous amount of road and street and concrete and steel and pipes and pumps and all these things. When the federal government pays 90% of that and we pay at the local level 10%, it feels a lot like growth. When the stuff falls apart and we have to go out and fix it, that basic maintenance becomes this overwhelming liability. And we just, in this pattern, have not created the tax base and the wealth sufficient enough to allow us to meet all those obligations.
So how did we get here? How did our cities come to this point where all of this sort of is coming to a head?
Well, I'm an engineer and a planner. I worked many, many years for cities doing big projects, doing these kind of growth initiatives, the things that cities do all the time to create jobs and economic development and tax base. There's a very kind of seductive thing at city halls that you get, and that is growth solves our immediate problem. Growth, when we can get a federal grant or a state program, when we can tap into the municipal bond market or get a developer to come to our city and make an investment, all of that creates transactions, and those create fees, create brand new tax base, and all those liabilities, fixing the road, fixing the pipes, fixing the sidewalks, that's out decades in the future. And so in the very short term, the faster we grow, the more of this kind of sugar high of cash that we get. But in conjunction with that, we take on these long-term liabilities. When those liabilities come due, we struggle. And the thing we tend to fall back on, the thing that we're encouraged by not only the federal and state governments, but by just the cultural notion of what cities should be doing, is we go try to get more growth. It becomes almost like a Ponzi scheme, where the more growth we've had in the past, the more we need in the future in order to make up for all the insolvencies in the pattern that we've created.
You speak a lot about how you've seen the consequences of this modern pattern of how we grow the and build communities in your hometown. Now, you're from Brainerd, Minnesota, but I'm sure that many of our Indiana towns can draw a lot of parallels. Can you talk a little bit about the tangible changes that you've seen in Brainerd over your lifetime?
Yeah, it's kind of amazing because I started to talk about Brainerd in the early days of this. I was actually trying to figure some things out here that didn't make a lot of sense. You know, projects I was working on that were obviously over the long term, big financial losers, yet, you know, there was all this support for it, despite the numbers. When I started to write about this, cities around the country started to call me, to email me, to get a hold of me and say, my gosh, this is the exact same thing we see here. So things like we went in and took out a block of buildings that we had labeled as blighted. They were single story, kind of pawn shop, consignment stores, liquor stores, tattoo parlor, that kind of thing. One of the most marginal pieces of property in the city. We did this. We removed this and we got a new drive-through franchise taco restaurant. And everybody was thrilled about this. We got rid of blight. We got something brand new. It fits the new highway corridor. The highway runs right through the middle of town. And that old development was pre-World War II. It was Depression development. This was, you know, new modern development. And everybody's really happy about this. It checked all the boxes in our kind of growth machine mentality. The problem is it actually devalued the tax base. That old rundown block is worth 77% more than the new block. It pays 77% more taxes. It employs more people. It actually had more local ownership. And so despite the fact that it was blighted and run down, it actually performed financially way better. Imagine if we had just taken care of it. Imagine if instead of running the highway and high-speed traffic through the middle of the neighborhood, cutting this place off from all its kind of customer base, we actually instead focused on nurturing that customer base. That block of buildings is in a neighborhood that is struggling. The people in that neighborhood tend to have to drive, you know, out to the edge of town, to the Walmart or to the big box grocery store in order to get their basic daily needs. That neighborhood used to have 10 local grocery stores, 10, you know, neighborhood places where you could get meat and essentials and milk and what have you on a day-to-day basis. Those places all employed people. They all provided local entrepreneurial opportunities. So we have systematically, in pursuit of growth and efficiency, particularly at the macro level, we have sacrificed a whole lot of resiliency, a whole lot of adaptability. We've taken away options from people who live in our community. And at the end of the day, we've devalued our tax base in the process. And when you're a city, you can't get by with doing that for a long time. After a while, those costs start to really, really bite. And that's what we see in cities all over North America, including all over Indiana.
So you're talking about something that we hear a lot, you know, that the big box store came in and ruined the small town. But I feel like we're at a point where you can't really reverse course, can we? I mean, how do we sort of either move toward that, or what's the best way to deal with the situation we're dealt?
It's a really hard question because it's not easy. We've created for ourselves a big predicament, a predicament that will unwind and have consequences for us no matter what we do. I find it interesting when people say the big box store wrecked the downtown. We all see that obvious connection, but it's often posed as an aesthetic or a desire. You know, we desire the downtown. We like the local businesses. What we're putting forth is that this is actually economically a disaster. My downtown has doubled the tax base of the biggest big box store out on the edge of town, despite being 8 acres less in land and having a lot less public infrastructure to serve it. So it actually costs less for us to have the downtown, and it produces way more wealth and tax base. That's something that was never part of our original conversation. So what we have to do is stop making these really bad investments. And you can think of, if you just want to correlate it, anytime we're taking on new road, new pipe, new infrastructure, it's almost certain that is going to be a negative returning investment. And we have to start making the kind of investments, and these tend to be small, incremental kind of things that actually afford on our budget, to reconnect the community, to basically put that fabric back in place.
So are you talking about prioritizing stability over prioritizing growth?
That's exactly how we talk about it. There's a trade-off at the local level between growth and stability. The traditional development pattern, the pre-Great Depression development pattern, had a lot of problems with it. And there was a reason why people opted for something new when that was presented as this highly subsidized option we could take. There's a lot of struggles with that pattern. You got to work with your neighbors. You got to figure out how to make ends meet, sometimes on limited budgets. There's a reason why our ancestors, and I say that in the broadest possible sense, you know, around the world for thousands of years, we see people building in this approach. They did it because it was really stable. It provided a solid base of wealth and resource to draw from. It could grow. It could even grow very, very quickly. But if it didn't experience growth, it didn't fall apart. It actually was strong, resilient, and adaptable. We have given up a lot of that strength and resiliency so we could experience growth. We now are in a position, particularly at the local level, where we actually need to give up some of that growth potential in order to buy back our stability. Stability is a prerequisite for cities.
But what can we then do with it? So the stability there so that we can kind of get our bearings and figure out how to move forward? Because that takes time, and lost time means lost potential, right?
I think we're kind of conditioned to think of it that way. I think maybe we could think about it in terms of like a local business versus a national franchise. You're in the media business. My wife has spent many, many years in newsprint and now is a radio journalist. When we look at local newspapers, we can see a franchise that can serve the community. A local newspaper can operate many, many years with a stable business model, earn a profit, the owners of that can live a really good life. As soon as that local business sells out to a national chain, which we see happen all over in smaller town America, now it's not just good enough to operate and make a good profit and a good living every year. You actually, by the denotion of not only the debt that corporation has that needs to be serviced, but also the needs of shareholders in a competitive marketplace, you have to increase profits every year. And so the macro pressures become very, very different and force you to do very different things than if you were merely a local owner as part of a business community in a stable way, making a really good living. There's nothing wrong with the former. There's nothing wrong with that stable living. There's nothing that prompts you to essentially get on this, this train, this Ponzi scheme to continually grow faster and faster. And that's the trap that our cities have gotten themselves in. I'm not suggesting getting off that train is going to be easy. We have a lot of commitments that we've made, commitments that we literally can't keep, that we're going to have to figure out what to do with. I think making that less of a burden, like stop doing those things, and then looking for ways to create wealth and prosperity within our neighborhoods, those are just prudent responses to the stresses that we're experiencing.
So we're talking a lot about data, and we're talking a lot about economic theory and strategy, as we should. But so much of this equation turns around the human element as well. Can you talk about what it means to embrace a humble form of public engagement?
Yeah. One of the things that we have done in this growth model we have is figured out how to systematically handle the public. Many times when I was an engineer, we would have a project that, was fully created at City Hall. It was something we wanted to do, a staff or some elected officials wanted to do. And our job was to go sell it to the public. And the way you sold it was you had public hearings and listening sessions, and you put a veneer of listening to people over top of this decision, so that when you got to the end, you could say things like, well, we had a hearing, you had your chance to have your say and all that. If we actually want to make really good investments in our communities, if we actually want to make investments that pay off financially, those have to be investments that are finely tuned to the needs that people living in our places have. The way we discern what those needs are is not the ways that we're used to, holding a hearing, asking people to come in and tell us what they're thinking. We get all kinds of distorted, self-serving ideas with that approach. We actually need to go out and humbly observe where people struggle. Go out with humility. So don't go out as an engineer and say, every problem is a traffic problem or every problem is an infrastructure problem. Don't go out as a planner and say, well, every problem is a zoning problem. Actually go out and see what the human problems are. Walk with people. Have them narrate their day. Try to observe and understand where they're having a difficult time working in and living in the community as we have built it. When we do that, what we find out is that a lot of the things that are needed are really small. How do I get across the street a little bit easier? How do I, traverse this lane in a way that's a little bit more comfortable, a little less despotic? And those investments are things we can hack. I mean, those are things that sometimes with paint and bales of straw and cones, we can actually make a little bit better on a very small, cheap budget. Cities that do this create these great feedback loops where the city makes a small investment and the public responds, and the city can respond to that and the public responds again. And you actually create this virtuous feedback loop where we're making very low risk, very high return investments that also make people's lives better. And that's a home run, however you measure it.
And finally, Strong Towns is more than just this book that I'm holding. You say that Strong Towns is a movement. What does this movement look like? What work are you all doing?
Well, I started writing a blog back in 2008 just to figure out some things that I was having confusion with in my own professions. And as I said earlier, people started to call, people started to respond. We've grown this now into a movement where we're going to have 3 million people reading our content during this year. We publish 2-3 articles a day. We've got multiple podcast streams. We go around the country doing events and talking to people about this. We have thousands of members, people who are trying to work in their communities to figure out what comes next. We don't pretend to understand exactly what every city should do. In fact, we say the exact opposite. These are complex adaptive systems, and the solutions in each place are going to be different. we have people around the country working together, connected to each other, saying, all right, this system doesn't work. What does? How do we figure this out? How do we make our neighborhoods better, more successful places? So if people want to plug in, strongtowns.org is a place to get all that content and to get connected to literally thousands of other people around the country and to some extent around the world who are working on similar problems in their place.
Chuck Marone, author of Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. Thanks for talking with us today.
Hey, thank you. It's been a lot of fun. I love this stuff, and there's a ton of momentum, so I appreciate you taking the time.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Subscribe to our podcast. And speaking of podcasts, we'll be back on Monday to revisit the acclaimed podcast Sick. Now that the first season's wrapped, we'll be joined by some of the voices central to that story. I'm Matt Pelser. Have a great weekend. This is All In.